This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
It's a child who gets sick, a child who is submerged in water but doesn't have access to clean water, then their health can very quickly deteriorate.
That's James Elder, Regional Chief of Communications for UNICEF, talking to us from Beira, Mozambique. Details coming up also. April 2019 marks the 25th anniversary of the outbreak of the genocide in Rwanda. The Comoros election body has declared President Azali Assoumani the winner of Sunday's election. And Algeria's largest labor union and an influential party today backed an army call for President Abdelaziz Bouteflika to leave office. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. April 2019 marks the 25th anniversary of the outbreak of the genocide in Rwanda, during which 800,000 to 1 million people were slaughtered in the span of 100 days. The Rwandan genocide is one of the heaviest moments in human history. To brief us on the planned commemoration events, we have in studio Eddie Rowema from VOA's Central Africa Service, who will be heading to Rwanda tomorrow. Welcome to Africa News Tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Eddie, what is going to be the emphasis of your coverage when you arrive there?
I would say that the emphasis is definitely April 7th. That's the day when they will be commemorating the 25th anniversary of the genocide. But throughout the week in Rwanda, I'll be able to speak to survivors, find out 25 years later how has their lives been. There's so many issues that come up, the issues of trauma. Many have lived through trauma, issues of justice. Many lived with their killers. And now, through the government program called Gachacha and Unity and Reconciliation, some have even come to terms to live with people who killed them because they asked for apology, and survivors said, yes, well, we'll forgive, but we'll not forget. So I'll be trying to capture all those stories and try to visualize, see the kind of life these people are going through, and also looking ahead, because after the Second World War, the world said that never again.
Never again.
But a couple years later, we saw it in Rwanda. We hear it in Myanmar. It might happen somewhere else. So what are the lessons that the international community needs to learn from Rwanda 25 years later? So those are the kinds of stories I want to capture when I'm there.
So for our audience, can you give us like a brief history of the genocide?
Well, the genocide happened in 1994. It was perpetrated and organized by the extremist Hutus. The Hutus in Rwanda were the majority, and the Tutsis were the minority. So this came 4 years after a liberation war that was waged by the Tutsis, who had lived outside Rwanda for 30 years because the government then deemed them as foreigners. So they decided to take arms and go and liberate their country and also have an opportunity and a right to live in their country. So when the then government saw that it was almost losing the war, then it perpetuated this plan telling Hutus, look, we're going to lose everything. These people are not our people. Most of them, you've heard of stories that they used to say that Tutsis came from Abyssinia. So they were called foreigners.
Their features resemble.
So through that campaign, the Hutus took up arms and machetes and started killing their neighbors. So that's how the genocide started. And then in just 100 days, like you said, 1 million people were dead.
So like you mentioned, Eddie, the hatred the Hutu unleashed represented the worst that human beings are capable. But in considering what led to the disaster, it is important to bear in mind that the violence was not spontaneous. Like you mentioned, 3.5 years before the genocide, a rebel army of mainly Rwandan Tutsis, exiles, mm-hmm. known as the Rwandan Patriotic Front,
yes.
RPF, invaded Rwanda and set up camps in northern mountains. Talk to us a little bit about the Uganda connection to the genocide.
Most of the leaders of the then liberation group, which was the Rwanda Patriotic Army, which was the armed wing of the Rwanda Patriotic Front, most of the cadres, high-ranking officials, were former Ugandan army officers. Mm-hmm. These are the people that Museveni started with in 1981 to launch a liberation war to liberate Uganda. So mostly at that time, these young Tutsi men didn't have a right to go to school, never had right to get jobs. So it was easy for Museveni to go to them and tell them, look, come help me, we liberate this country, and then after that, I will help you to liberate your country. That's
the connection.
Yeah.
So what is the relation right now between Rwanda and Uganda?
Unfortunately, the relationship seems to be very bad right now.
Why?
You've heard of stories of some people say that Uganda wants to consider Rwanda as a district of Uganda because these are people he worked with, these are people he helped put to power, so he wants to control them as a father. So, and sometimes Kigali thinks, no, we are independent, we are a sovereign nation, you shouldn't be doing this. And then through that, there has been issues of spying against each other's country. Rwanda has been trying to penetrate the Ugandan intelligence. And then the Uganda also has also been trying to help the Rwandan opposition, most of whom live in South Africa, to try to build a rebellion to attack Rwanda. So that's how the tension started. Right now, you've heard of stories of Rwanda closing its borders.
Yes.
You've heard of stories of Rwanda advising its citizens not to go to Uganda, because these days, most of them, when they go to Uganda, Ugandans consider them as spies and they get arrested.
Tensions and border.
Yes.
Eddie Ruima from VOA Central Africa Service, thank you for your input.
Thank you so much for your time.
Nearly 2 weeks after Cyclone Idai struck southeastern Africa, large amounts of aid are moving into Mozambique. The storm left more than 700 people dead in Mozambique, Malawi, and Zimbabwe. Floods following the storm have displaced hundreds of thousands of people. Aid agencies are racing not just to get food and shelter to survivors, but also prevent deadly disease outbreaks. The Mozambique government today confirmed that it has found cases of cholera, a potentially fatal disease transmitted by contaminated water. James Elder is the regional chief of communications for UNICEF, and he is in Beira, Mozambique, working with the relief teams. He spoke with my colleague Kate Pound Dawson a short time ago about the situation in Mozambique. He says getting clean drinking water to the region is a primary mission.
They're distressing. People are in distress, and they're kind of distressing to be surrounded by overwhelming needs, to be honest. Entire communities were submerged, so you've still got areas where trees are violently strewn across homes in a major city, power lines down, families still arriving in reception centres, exhausted, unwell, and really with nothing. I did a flyover in a helicopter yesterday of areas that hadn't yet been reached, and you see people still looking for help. You see cattle and livestock that have either drowned or stuck in the mud. I mean, honestly, rarely, and I include conflict zones, have I seen such devastation. When you say a million children, a crisis that's only a couple of weeks old, a million children require help, it really is an astounding number.
How much aid is getting in, and what more is going to be needed?
Yeah, at the moment, the aid response is very intense, I have to say. Whenever people are suffering, it could be more done. That's my way of looking at things. But certainly, from a UNICEF perspective, I've seen planes arrive every other day now, another plane yesterday, another plane today. These are cargo planes. A ship again came in today. Our warehouse was
horribly destroyed in Beira, the cyclone, the eye of the storm hit. But we played very, very quick catch-up. So there's food drops from World Food Programme. This is now a case of reuniting children. It's about building health centres. Cholera was announced just a couple of hours ago. That's the disaster that we feared but wasn't unexpected. So in that sense, we've already rebuilt a water system. We've already got cholera treatment centres in place. So it's a very, very intense aid response. It really is people doing 18 hours a day, one meal a day, and I think that will continue in the coming days and weeks.
And what are the special needs for children that UNICEF is seeking to address?
I think the most critical need is just one that it can sound a bit bland. It's water. And it's whether it's a grandmother or a child, but of course a child who gets sick, a child who is submerged in water but doesn't have access to clean water, then their health can very quickly deteriorate. I mean, that's what cholera is. It's spread in feces and sewage-contained water or food. And here, of course, we had thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of people, children in most cases, trapped for days and days and submerged by flooding. These people had no access to clean water. So clean water is absolutely paramount. The other thing we're doing is, of course, so many children were separated. I've heard horror story after horror story of parents going out in the storm to try and rescue someone and being hit hard by some flying debris. It could be a plate, it could be a sheet of metal from roofing, and suddenly you've got these children when the storm has subsided, surrounded by devastation, but without family members to be seen. So reunifying kids within communities and hopefully with family members is an absolute priority as we try and minimize the trauma. And then never forget the basics of school. Never forget that just getting kids back into some sort of normality really is critical after they've endured the horrors from this cyclone.
That's James Elder with the United Nations Children's Agency, UNICEF, in Beira. He was speaking with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson. Algeria's largest labor union and an influential party today backed an army call for President Abdelaziz Bouteflika to leave office. But protesters have rejected their proposal for a managed transition of power. The National Rally for Democracy, a member of the ruling coalition, called for Bouteflika to leave office a day after the military said the president should be declared unfit for office. The General Union of Algerian Workers, which has supported the president, also said Bouteflika should step down. Yesterday, the Algerian Army Chief of Staff, Ahmed Gaid Salah, said the ailing 82-year-old Bouteflika should be declared incapacitated. Earlier this month, Bouteflika called off elections scheduled for next month and said he would not run for a fifth term. Algeria has seen weeks of protests calling for Bouteflika to resign and demanding major political changes. Egyptian-Americans hosted a congressional briefing on Capitol Hill along with human rights organizations to express concerns about Egypt's human rights record and proposed constitutional amendments. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi has the details.
Participants at the two-day Egypt Advocacy Day this week put a spotlight on human rights in Egypt. One of their big concerns was the proposed constitutional amendments that would extend presidential terms and give the military a role in protecting democracy. Dalia Fahmy is a professor of political science at Long Island University in New York. She says the amendments also give the army a larger role in the government.
That the military could step in and remove the president, dissolve parliament, that it's the military that is in primary position of authority. So the level of crystallizing of a military regime and extreme authoritarianism will now be in the Constitution and protected by the Constitution.
Fahmy says the proposed amendments would make it possible for a president to serve for life and give the president expanded oversight of the judiciary. She says there are fears the amendments will worsen what she and other activists called an environment of repression and human rights violations, including torture. Last week, the United States State Department's annual human rights report expressed similar concerns about rights abuses in Egypt. The Egyptian Foreign Ministry said the report was not objective and relies on what the ministry described as false information provided by non-governmental organizations with political agendas. One of the event participants was Amr Waked, an Egyptian actor who starred in the Hollywood hit Syriana. An Egyptian military court has sentenced him in absentia to 8 years in prison because of his criticism of President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. Waked told U.S. policymakers that relying on one man with ultimate power in Egypt would not serve American interests. He calls on Egyptian Americans to engage more with U.S. political leaders.
The way forward to try and influence policy in the United States is by forming a lobby of American Egyptians who have regular meetings with American politicians to bring onto the table the issues that have been hidden by the Egyptian lobbyists that represent the regime.
Khaled Abu Naga, another Egyptian actor, told the briefing audience the Egyptian government's strict controls of public expression could hamper U.S. efforts to counter extremism.
Right now, young people who everybody was proud of in 2011, most of them are behind bars or behind bars of fear that exasperate and have a better environment for more extremism and more radicalization.
Egypt Actors Union has expelled Abu Naga and Waked for their testimony this week. Congressman Tom Malinowski, a former State Department Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights, told the hearing audience he has concerns about the proposed constitutional amendments.
These constitutional amendments formalize the role of the army in Egypt's political life in a way that should make us very, very troubled here in the United States, and that should make us reevaluate the relationship between the United States and the Egyptian military.
Malinowski pledged to push to have the U.S. government make aid to Egypt dependent on progress on human rights, democracy, and the rule of law. The Egyptian media, which is dominated by the government, accused participants at the hearing of attempting to get the U.S. Congress to use aid to pressure Cairo. President Sisi came to power in 2013 after the military ousted President Mohamed Morsi. He won a 2014 election and was re-elected in 2018. Rights activists have said both elections were deeply rigged in his favor. Mohamed El-Shenawi, VOA News, Washington.
The Comoros election body has declared President Azali Assoumani the winner of Sunday's election, saying that no runoff vote would be needed. In the announcement Tuesday evening, the election commission said Azali had 60% of the vote and his nearest rival, Mahamadou Ahamada, had 14%. The election has drawn criticism from the opposition and international monitors amid allegations of cheating. Members of the opposition say the vote was a fraud, and many opponents say they are starting a campaign of civil disobedience against Azali. The president's supporters dismissed the allegations of cheating. Observers from the African Union, the COMESA East and Southern Africa Bloc, and the Eastern Africa Standby Force have said the vote lacked credibility and transparency. The tiny impoverished island nation of Comoros has experienced 20 coup d'etats or attempted takeovers since independence from France in 1975. More than 100 of the Chibok schoolgirls remain in captivity nearly 5 years after Boko Haram militants in Nigeria abducted them from their school. President Muhammadu Buhari has promised to make the rescue of the girls and other abductees a top priority. Some have been released, but advocacy groups say Buhari's government, in its focus on the economy, has largely forgotten the girls who are still being held. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
The last time Charity Job saw her daughter, Awa, was on the morning of April 14, 2014, when the girl left for school in Chibok. Awa was among the 276 girls who were abducted later that day by Boko Haram and one of the 112 still in captivity. The insurgents came and took our children, including mine and those of my relatives, from their school. Some of us developed high blood pressure and died as a result of the incident. We that survived, we have children. If I die, who will take care of them? The Chibok mass abduction in 2014 triggered a global outcry and sparked the creation of the Bring Back Our Girls movement, PBOG, in Nigeria. Today, parents of the girls like Sule Kwari still hope their children will return home one day. We've been coming from time to time to search for our girls. Sometimes when we come, we have to wait for the sun to go down. And some people faint from the heat, and sometimes we go back very starved, he says. Advocacy group PBOG says the government is not doing enough to ensure the release of the remaining girls. Although the group has been seeing fewer numbers at its rallies, coordinator Gapani Yanga says they will not relent until the government takes action.
Since the 106 Chibok girls are released, we have not heard anything from the from federal government. Federal government have to stand up, have to stand up to their responsibility.
In October 2016, Nigeria's government secured the safe release of some 21 girls. Another 82 were released in May 2017. Al-Kazim Abdulkadir is spokesperson of the Presidential Committee on the Northeast Initiative. He says the committee is negotiating the release of more girls.
I'm sure very soon we'll reach a middle ground where some of the abductees will be released to their families and to the society at large.
In 2015, then-candidate Buhari promised the release of the abducted Chibok girls and others taken by Boko Haram would be his top priority. As the girls' abduction nears its fifth anniversary, advocates say it is time Buhari puts their rescue at the top of his agenda again. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
And Pope Francis today gave a special medal to an 85-year-old nun for her work as a midwife in the Central African Republic. Sister Maria Concetta Isu stood by the Pope's side at the Vatican as he talked of her work. Since arriving in Africa more than 60 years ago from Italy, she has helped deliver nearly 3,000 babies. The leader of the world's Roman Catholics praised Sister Maria Concetta's work, which he said was in the service of life, of children, of women, and of families. Also today, the Vatican said Pope Francis will visit Madagascar, Mauritius, and Mozambique in September. He travels to Morocco Saturday and Sunday of this week. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Rob McLean, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, Cyclone Idai battered parts of southern Africa, wreaking havoc and creating a massive humanitarian crisis. An in-depth look at how the international community and the local governments are dealing with this evolving crisis on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.